Subcommittee of General Government. Yesterday, when we completed the hour, we were taking testimony from Mr. Pete Shepard, the special counsel to the Attorney General's office, and to the Department of Justice. And we'd invite Mr. Shepard and Mr. Fuller, if you'd like to come forward. I have received some information. I did not see copies of it. I'm going to put Ontario, Canada on that second sheet, which is number page 3. Is that right, Mr. Shepard?
Chair, yes, the second sheet would be the sheet that's oriented vertically on your material.
And that was Ontario, Canada?
That's correct.
Okay, so those have also been Canadian dollars.
I think that's correct.
Okay, why don't I just go ahead and hand that around? I've had an opportunity to take a look at that. This is the Virginia and Ontario, Canada fund, which does similar to what we are proposing for in House Bill 2734. And this continues yesterday's meeting, which is public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2734. When we closed off yesterday, we were taking testimony relative to the Bandon Ford and the upper limits that are reflected in the bill. Just by way of review, we talked about the number of audits, investigations, and the complaints driven. Now, the DMV, it's my understanding, has 7 investigators, and there was a number of dealers. How many dealers are there in the state that they're investigating, or that their oversight is?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of the number of dealers. So.
Mr. Chairman, I'm members of the committee. My name is Darrell Fuller. I represent the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. Kelly Taylor corrected me. She believes they have 5 investigators, and there are approximately just under 3,000 licensed dealers in Oregon.
That's new and used.
New and used, manufactured housing, motorcycles.
3,000? Nearly 3,000. Okay.
I'm advised that approximately correct.
Okay. So, and those are the licensed dealers. Now, while we have Mr. Shepard here, I would like to have some idea about the actual ongoing, the number of cases that are ongoing on a regular basis, and what information we have there relative to bonds that are actually being paid out or charges that are being brought. Senator Trill is recognized.
Mr. Shepard, while you're here, why is this a good deal for the consumer? It looks like the consumer's going to pay for this, isn't he? He's going to pay the $5 increased fee. The consumer's going to pay $10 increased paperwork. And that's essentially the money the dealers are putting in. It's the money that the consumer's paying. Why is this a good deal for the consumer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, it's a good deal for consumers, and I don't dispute the proposition that some dealers will choose to pass through these costs, though I would say that not all dealers necessarily will.
There's some guarantee that they won't?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, there's no prohibition on that, any more than there is any prohibition on the dealer passing through any other overhead costs that the dealer incurs. The reason that it's a good deal for the consumer is that at $25,000, which is the amount of the bond that's available to protect consumers, consumers are exposed to the risk of a much greater loss than there is the probability of recovery in the event that dealer does not.
Isn't that the dealer's obligation to pay for that loss? It's the dealer that's creating the problem, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, that is correct. It is the dealer's obligation to pay for the loss. The reality of the situation is that when a dealership fails, however, the dealer is not in a position to make good on that obligation, and it is the consumer.
And it's collectively all the consumers who make good on it by having paid the fee.
Chair Senator Trow, I think that in effect is the case, that all consumers would to the extent that dealers choose to pass these fees on to consumers, it would be a cost that...
You're saying that the present situation is not adequate and the consumer ends up eating this and it's not the dealer that suffers. The dealer goes bankrupt or something, but the dealer's gone, the consumer, and the dealer goes to another state and starts up again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, typically the dealer doesn't go to another state and start, although apparently that's the example in the South Coast matter, but they just go out of business, and their assets are not available to satisfy their obligations, and the consumers, the people who are least able to protect themselves against this kind of loss, are the ones who suffer the loss in the end.
I'm going to put up the money, essentially, probably, to create this fund that will indemnify them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Crowe, if I may respond to that as well. There isn't a business in Oregon that doesn't pass through every cost. That's how you generate a profit. So if we were to eliminate the recovery fund proposal and simply increase the bond, for example, to $250,000, the cost of that bond would be borne by consumers who purchase the vehicles, because that's how dealers cover their overhead costs, is by taking everything it costs them to administer their business and then add enough on for a profit. So regardless of what kind of proposal the legislature looks at, the current $15,000 bond is passed on to consumers. It doesn't cost a lot of money to buy a $15,000 bond, so the increased cost to consumers for that is relatively minor. When you start moving to a higher bond, obviously the dollars are more, and that will eventually be passed on to consumers ultimately.
Well, what about the $10 registration fee increase? Is that something that's just going to be pocketed by the dealer, or does it really cost that much to do all this paperwork? It sounds like it's pretty much something that's been done.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Crowe, let me respond to another part of your previous question, then I'll get to your second one, and that is the $5 fee. And it's important to note that that $5 fee is an initial funding of the recovery fund, and it's estimated that it'll only be about 3 to 4 months of those $5 per vehicle charges to get the fund to $700,000. And at that point, that $5 per vehicle fee goes away. And so that is not a perpetual fee on consumers. Yeah, so for a period of 3 or 4 months, that pays, which answers actually another question that was asked about whether existing dealers participate in the recovery fund, because the way it's set up is the fund continues by new entrants into the marketplace paying $650 when they get their original license, and then $300 when they get their renewal in 3 years. So the appearance is that existing dealers don't pay into the fund, when the reality is it's existing dealers that pay that $5 fee into the fund, where a lot of existing dealers, especially some of my larger dealers, will be paying 3, 4, 5 times as much into the recovery fund than new dealers would at $5 per vehicle. So the notion that existing dealers don't pay into the fund is not accurate. In fact, we will pay, most of my dealers will pay well in excess of the $1,100 that new entrants into the marketplace will be required to pay through the recovery fund.
Their consumers will.
Well, and with the new entrants, the consumers will pay that ultimately as well. As
part what about of the other fees, though?
The other fee is document preparation fee. There are 46 states that permit document preparation fees for auto dealers. In those 46 states, 29 of them don't even regulate the amount. It is a market-based fee that dealers charge consumers for preparing the paperwork needed in order to complete the sale of a vehicle and protection of the security interest and the title and the registration. There are 19 states in which the document preparation fee is set by either statute or rule or an agreement. Oregon is on the low end of those states that charge document preparation fee.
What's the number of fees?
It's currently $35 by administrative rule. This changes it to $45 and changes it from rule to statute, which is something both to the Department of Justice and the...
And that's continuous, and that's for every dealer, and it doesn't end when the fund is filled.
Well, that is an optional fee that dealers may charge, and that is a ceiling on how much they can charge.
Why is that charge this bill? Do you need that money to pay for this fund?
It is not necessary. It is not part of the recovery fund per se, and was not part of the original recovery fund proposal, which I believe was Senate Bill 382. This, like many bills through this process, is a cobbled together agreement. We have for a long time believed that the administrative fee ought to be set by statute if it's going to be established. Our philosophical position, frankly, is that it ought not be capped by the state at all. In a free market system, we ought to be able to charge what the market will bear. which is what most states do, recognizing that we are regulated by the state, and that it is going to be a cap set by some government entity, we feel more comfortable with the legislature setting that amount than an administrative agency. We're a little put off, frankly, by having to come to the legislature to increase a fee when every catalog that you buy anything from, and I recently bought a $200 bedspread through a catalog, I paid a $50 shipping and handling fee for a $200 item. We're talking about a $45 dock fee for a $20,000 item. Yet the Department of Justice isn't rushing to tell JCPenney's that they can't charge X amount for dock fees. So shipping and handling and document preparation fees are part of the marketplace. Ours is at the low end in terms of states that are regulated, and at the low end in comparison to all retail markets.
I was wondering, has anybody done an estimate of what it costs to do that paperwork?
It's difficult to... we've tried doing assessments of that. We have people in our...
Differently depending on the dealer.
Well, it does, depending on volume, and we have what are called title clerks in our business, which are employees who do exclusively collecting taxes and filling out paperwork, essentially on behalf of the government. We collect, and I don't have the number with me, millions and millions of dollars in taxes on behalf of the state of Oregon every year. Up until 1997, statute specifically prohibited dealers from collecting any sort of fees in exchange for collecting all that taxes and doing all those paperwork. There is a specific statutory prohibition. Now, the 1997 legislature passed a bill, and the governor signed the bill, that removed that cap, which is part of the reengineering of the DMV and allowing private enterprise to go in and do some of the work that DMV is currently doing. And part of that entire process was removing that cap that prevented dealers from charging fees for document preparations.
That's true.
Thank you, Senator. Let me just make sure that I understand that you're collecting millions and millions of dollars of taxes for the state of Oregon on an annual basis. Is that the registration fee? Is that what
that's registration and filing fee?
Registration fee. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
And all of those go to the state. The
registration and titling fees go directly to the state.
That's
registration, title, and plate fees.
But this fee, then...
This is a fee that the dealers can charge and do keep to cover the cost of hiring and training title clerks. And it is a fee that I would guess somewhere in the range of 75% to 80% of my dealers charge. Not all of them do. And consumers are not required. We cannot require consumers to pay that fee. We are a negotiated price item. If we get into the closing room and the consumer says, I don't want to pay that $45 fee, I can assure you dealers are not going to lose a $20,000 sale over a $45 fee. They'll just adjust it off. It is a fee that we are permitted by statute to charge if we want to. But it is not a required fee, and it is not a government fee, and we cannot represent it as such, or Mr. Shepherd will be in our offices.
But none of that fee goes into this fund.
No.
Right. Okay. That's something that's cobbled into this bill.
Okay. Representative Martin is recognized.
Why do you need a statute to have the ability to charge a discretionary fee? Why can't you just say we're going to charge you $45 to cover our overhead?
Chairman Butler, Representative Leonard, that's a good question. There are 29 other states that are silent in their statutes and regulations on charging document preparation fees, and dealers do that, and the range of the fee is anywhere from $25 to $250. And it is left up to the dealer and the consumer to negotiate the final price of an automobile. The Department of Justice had, I believe, prohibited any kind of document preparation fees prior to around 1993, in which they wrote an administrative rule permitting us to charge up to $35. I would tend to agree that I don't believe the government ought to be telling private enterprise how much they can charge consumers for a service they're providing. But the Department of Justice saw fit to pass an administrative rule that did regulate how much we can charge for that fee. And we believe, and the Department of Justice has come to the conclusion, that that fee is better set through the legislature in a statutory process rather than through an administrative rules process. And so as part of this bill, we have moved that fee from rule into statute, and the fee was increased by $10.
You see, in this bill, amended it so that the fee was still $35. Would you still support the bill?
Representative Butler, Representative Leonard, I would have to check with my legislative committee to ask what their interest would be. We asked the Department of Justice to make probably close to a dozen to a dozen and a half changes in the recovery fund bill, and in the process of negotiating an agreement. This is somewhat like, I believe, House Bill 3602 that the legislature recently passed, which is a justified reporting bill, where you spend a lot of time between the regulators and the regulated getting together and finding a package that everybody can come to the table and agree to. If any part of the package were to be changed, then I would have to go back to my leadership, and I'm sure that Mr. Shepard would have to go back to the Attorney General and make sure that any changes made in this process are accepted by everybody that's come to the table together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, perhaps I can illuminate a little bit the policy reasons for the cap on the fee. The problem that the Department of Justice frequently sees, even with the existing rule which permits up to a $35 fee, and that indeed is the only limit now that prevents dealers from charging whatever they can get from a consumer. The problem that we see, even though the rule is clear that it's a negotiable item and not required of the consumer, we hear complaints from consumers that in the closing room the dealer represents this as a governmental fee, and therefore the consumer perceives that it is not a negotiable item and is simply added on to the price. Now, that's the worry that we have about completely going the direction of the 19 states or however many it is, the 29 that do not regulate the fees at all, because we fear that that historical experience with a few dealers would be repeated, and that consumers would end up paying what effectively is a market-based fee, but it would be misrepresented in the closing room as a
part. If the rules are silent on it, and the statute is silent on fees, and there's no authority to allow fees or to not allow fees, how can a dealer be presented as a government fee? Doesn't that just the mere fact that you have an administrative rule actually make it easier for them to charge the fee?
Chair, Representative Leonard, that was part of the balance that we engaged in when we did the adopt the rule, I think it was in 94. And the answer to the question, I think, is that it isn't a matter of what it's lawful for them to represent. It's how it's perceived as by the consumer and how it is represented in the closing room. In other words, whatever the law, even though the law now says that a dealer may not represent this as a governmental fee, nonetheless, we still receive complaints from consumers that that's being done in the closing room. And I think that would be more likely to happen, frankly, in the absence of any constraint by the government.
Well, what happened before you had a rule? I mean, were they...
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, we had the problem. And the rule was that we had complaints from consumers that... that there were attempts to collect these fees, but prior to the rule, that there was a statute which on its face prohibited that practice. So we had at the time the rule was adopted, we had both a statute and a rule. And the statute said you can't collect for performing Department of Transportation services that have been delegated to you, such as the titling process. The dealers, we received repeated complaints that dealers were nonetheless attempting to collect from consumers a document fee in the closing room. And so we adopted the rule in an effort to clarify for the dealers what they could and could not do and to define a standard of conduct for the consumers. In the absence of a statute and the absence of a rule, simply a market-based rate, we fear that we would have greater opportunity for that kind of mischief in the closing room.
Let me just ask you a question regarding something that I heard a few moments ago to make sure that I understand. In Section 11, it provides for the $11 per motor vehicle to build up the $700,000 fund, and that'll take testimony in between 3 and 4 months, perhaps, to build that.
$5 per vehicle.
At $5, right, to build up the $700,000. And that's on top of the Section 14 fee of $45, but those two can't be lumped together. So the document preparation fee, which is presently charged, and I never did understand that when I bought a car, what the document preparation fee was, and now I do, would now go by statute to $45. And they can't put another $5, so we're really not talking about $50 total
document preparation fee and statutory fund?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are separate fees, but and they go to separate places. So the $45 presumably, to the extent the dealer decided to collect that.
Okay, stop right there. Stop that statement. Now I want to ask Mr. Fuller, do you know of any dealer who does not have that line on the for the present $35 on as a separate line item and just eats it? Is there any dealer in the state that you're aware of that just eats it?
Mr. Chairman, as I testified earlier, I believe approximately 80% of my 75 to 80% of my dealers charge that fee. There are a number of dealers that do not charge that fee. It is not an obligated fee. And we've surveyed our dealers and discovered, much to our surprise, that there are quite a number of dealers that do not charge that fee. To the $5 fee, when we had the financial protection work group during the interim and were discussing this idea, it in fact was the consumer groups who brought to the table the notion that, well, since this is a consumer protection fund, that maybe consumers ought to participate in paying for the fund and keeping the fund going. And the original thought was maybe there ought to be a $1 per title transaction fee that goes into the fund that the consumers will pay, or that somehow the consumers ought to be participating in the creation of this fund. It was determined subsequent to that there would be constitutional problems with taking titling and registration money and putting it into a recovery fund, because all titling and registration money has to go into the highway fund. So the $5 fee that you see represented in the bill is a fee that we specifically cannot add as a line item and pass directly on to the consumer because of the potential constitutional problem. I've talked to my counterpart in the used car dealer business, Monty King, who is traveling and unable to be there today, and our representation to both of our associations is that this is a $5 fee that the dealer would pay, and this is not something that would be added as a line item in the closing room as an additional fee that consumers would pay. So the addition that consumers would see from the bill on their in the closing room, per se, would be instead of seeing a $35 fee, they would see a $45 fee, not an increase of 35 to 45 plus 5. And again, there are dealers who would not charge the 35, who still will not charge the 45, and who will not be able to charge the 5.
I guess the reason I asked that and wanted to stop right there was because I have never seen in 40 years of car shopping, I've never seen the $35 or the document preparation fee just eaten up in a transaction. It's always a separate line item, and I just wanted, that's why, and I guess I hadn't recognized that you'd already given testimony that about 80% do have it as a separate line item. The others, I assume they must be smaller operators, because otherwise they'd be walking past the $35 add-on that they could get on every transaction, or $45 under the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And again, that is because a vehicle is a negotiated price item, and the consumer has the right to walk away from the table anytime before they sign a piece of paper, when they get into the closing room, and I've had many dealers tell me that they're not going to, you know, charge a $45 fee or stickle on a $45 fee and lose a $20,000 deal. If the consumer says, I really don't want to pay that, it can be adjusted off. Certainly, if consumers are willing to pay it, then the dealers are going to charge the whatever appropriate fees they can to recover their costs for filing and registration and other document preparation work.
All my haggling in all these years has never done me any good, because when I said I'm not going to pay more than $20,000 or $15,000 or whatever it is that we settle on, when we finally shake hands and agree and everybody shakes their head yes, I go and sign the papers and there it is, $20,135, and the $100 is for something else, and the $35 is for the preparation.
Did you see the movie Fargo, Mr. Chair?
I didn't. I'm sorry.
Well, there's a scene. It just reminded me of a man in a room where they added on some money. So I can't imagine using the language he did, though.
Senator Perriol, does it become an issue? Were you separated from John Gotti at birth?
So, Mr. Chairman, did you want the undercoating with that?
The auction electricity is
on the car.
It's more expensive to scrape it off than the paper. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I could direct your attention to the handout that I left with you this morning, it does discuss on page 2, by the way, the cost of having a recovery fund versus the cost of increasing the bond. The first decision that I believe the committee needs to make is whether or not we want to have an increase in consumer protection. Page 1 of the information I submitted to you indicates that the bond has not been changed since 1955. Imagine if your salaries had not even had a cost of living increase since 1955. So we are dealing with $1,955 in a 1999 environment, and that harms consumers. I think everybody universally agrees that we need to increase consumer protection. If we adjust the bond for inflation in 1997, and the testimony on my first page is for an increase in the bond in 1997, the bond would be in excess of $250,000 today.
What would it cost to buy a bond?
And if you look on page 2 of the information I presented, a bond, I've got a letter from Federated Insurance, which is an insurance company that offers bonds to new car dealers. They indicated that a new car dealer would pay approximately $1,300 a year for a $250,000 bond. Now, recognize
$1,300
a year for a $250,000 bond. Now, recognize that new car dealers are some of the best financed and most stable in the car environment, in the auto sales environment. A used car dealer or a smaller operator or somebody new coming into the marketplace for the first time that has fewer assets available and has a less stable financial past are going to pay considerably more than that. In the model that I've shown on page 2, I increased the price to just $1,500 when, in fact, somebody who newly coming into the marketplace could well pay $2,000 to $2,500 or even more for a $250,000 bond every year. Under the recovery fund, their initial payment is $650, and through the bill, you would still be required to have a $25,000 bond. That's a first-year payout of $900 for the consumers having essentially $275,000 worth of protection, $250,000 through the recovery fund and $25,000 through the bond. If that same first-year car dealer would purchase a $250,000 bond, they would be laying out more than that, an extra $600 for the one-year bond. In year two, because we're a three-year license cycle, okay, you pay $650, you don't pay into the fund again until you renew your license 3 years later. So in year two under the recovery fund, all you're buying is a $25,000 bond. If we increase the bond to $250,000, in year two, that new car dealer is paying another $1,500. And if you go down through the end, it's the beginning of the seventh year of a new car, new entrance into the marketplace. Under the recovery fund, that dealer would pay $2,800. Under a $250,000 bond scenario, that same dealer would be paying $10,500 for a similar protection. So having a recovery fund is substantially less expensive for smaller and new dealers coming into the marketplace for the same amount of protection. In fact, if we were to go to a $250,000 bond, there are a lot of existing small dealers that would go out of business because either A, they could not afford to pay for the bond, or B, they would simply never qualify to receive a bond because of the underwriting requirements. They may be able to come up with the $1,300 to $1,500 to pay for the bond, but they would never qualify for the assets test. And so if you agree as a committee, as a legislature, that we need more consumer protection, then you've got to decide how to do it. And increasing the bond is the most expensive way to do it. And it ensures fewer people coming into the marketplace, and it ensures that some smaller good businessmen now have to go out of business because they won't qualify for the bond.
I'm not sure you convinced me that it's the most expensive way. I think it's the most expensive way for the dealer, but I'm not sure it's the most expensive way, period. I don't know. Am I right or wrong?
If there's a different solution out there, Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, if there's something other than a recovery fund or an increase in the bond that provides consumer protection, I'm not aware of what it is, and there's no other state in the nation that's using that solution.
Oh, those bond rates are expensive, but it seems to me that you can buy the bonds for these people for less money than we're going to be putting into this fund and talking about. I don't know whether I'm right or wrong. What do you think, Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think actually there are two parts. I I think Mr. Fuller's analysis over a period of years suggests that it is cheaper to do the recovery fund route. But the second part of the balance here is that in addition to when one increases the bond amount, the bond company responds in two ways. First, by increasing the price, the cash price of the bond. And I think that's the question your question goes to. But the second thing that happens is that the bond company increases the underwriting requirements. That's what we've been told anyway. That at a certain point, when the bond gets beyond a certain point, whether it's 30,000 or 50,000 or 75,000, but certainly at 250,000, which is the protection provided by the recovery fund, the bonding company then begins to have underwriting requirements in terms of the assets that that person who's purchasing the bond has to demonstrate in order to show that the bond company can be repaid if it has to pay out claims of $250,000 on behalf of Fuller Automotive.
That might exclude a number of dealers who simply could not show those kinds of assets.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, we know that it would exclude a number of dealers, and it would exclude dealers who are performing properly in the marketplace and not causing consumer injury. And that's the real policy concern that has caused us to move toward the recovery fund concept, which only increases the cash price but does not increase the underlying requirements.
Thank you, Gerald, Mr. Fuller, for providing us this analysis. That clears up a lot with regard to the fee itself for the recovery fund, because it is a two-year fee.
The first
2 years after the first year, you have 2 years that are open, and then you pay it in the third year, of operation, and then you got 2 years open, and you pay it in the seventh year, and then after that, the only fee that would be charged would be if the funds in the $700,000 master fund somehow drop below the $700,000. Now, and that would be a special assessment at that point.
If you were to add a special assessment to that column in every year of those 7 years, let's just say a new entrance in into the marketplace where I get a special assessment every year of his first 7 years, the cost of the recovery fund with that annual special assessment is still less than half of the cost of purchasing a $250,000 bond on an annual basis. And you'll see that in the bottom note that I have underneath the graph. You would add $2,100 to the $2,800 for a total of less than
$5,000.
And you have, again, in the total payout of $10,500 for seven $250,000 bonds is actually a very low fee for a new entrant in the marketplace. Most of them, again, it would be $1,300 for a $250,000 bond for a new car dealer. Somebody who's coming into the marketplace for the first time, whose assets are not as substantial as an established new car dealer, there are indications that if they could qualify for the bond, if they could meet the underwriting requirements, that they may well pay $2,500 to $3,000 for that $250,000 bond. The representatives of the bonding companies may have a better grasp of whether or not a bond like that would even be available to somebody newly coming into the marketplace and what that would be. The bonding company that represents a majority of our new car dealers, or at least a vast number of them, have indicated that we would pay $1,300 a year for that protection. And the total payout by a new entrant into the marketplace is $1,100 over a period of 3 years. The existing dealers, because of the $5 per vehicle fee to fund the fund, we pay that same amount, essentially, or more, depending on the number of vehicles we sell in that three-month period of time. We could pay two or three times that $1,100, and we have to come up with the money in a period of 3 months, where the new entrant to the marketplace has a period of 7 years to come up with that $1,100.
Okay, just to kind of finalize that summary, then, this doesn't include any of the $5 amounts that you're paying on top of that, and that would be in addition on either side of the Schedule 2.
Well, there would be no $5 amount on the right-hand column, which is a strict $250,000 bond.
I see. Everybody would just have a $250,000.
Everybody would just have a if the policy decision of the committee and the legislature were that we wanted to increase consumer protection, essentially provide consumers with a cost of living increase in their protection, then we would be somewhere between $250,000 to $300,000 worth of protection. If we agree that that's the direction we want to go, the only two options I'm aware of are the $250,000 bond or a recovery fund. If we go the free market way and let the marketplace use a $250,000 bond to solve the problem, then there is no recovery fund, there's no $5 fees, there's just an increase in the requirement for the bond, and you lose a substantial number of your small existing dealers, and very few people went into the marketplace simply because they could not qualify.
So as I understand that, though, the $5 fee would be on top of the potentially up to $5,000. And as you've indicated, a newer used car dealer would likely, if they're in the same business, would just pass that cost on.
Well, the left-hand column is the first 7 years of a new entrant into the marketplace. So they would not be paying any of that $5 fee because the $5 fee would get the fund up to the $700,000, and then that fee goes away.
That's right. That's all taken care of
by existing dealers. The fees that you see in the left-hand column is the new entrants into the marketplace. Now, it is possible that during that three-month period that we're collecting the $5 per vehicle to reach, and that's 140,000 vehicles sold, to reach $700,000. Now, it is possible in that three-month period of time that somebody could start a new dealership. They would pay their $650, and for the first 2 or 3 months of their operation, they would have to pay $5 per vehicle if they happen to start a dealership that coincides during that period of time that we're collecting the $5 fee. So there is a possibility that there would be a small number of people that would end up paying both sets of fees, but that would be a very limited number of people.
Just those new entrants into the... And this the issue of the $250,000 bond, going back to the work group that has been working on this since 1997, was there any discussion in that process about vehicle dealers that maybe have fewer sales versus the franchise dealers that have perhaps more sales and bonding limits at various levels? What was the nature of that discussion so that you're not looking at an onerous bond for a new dealer that maybe he has, or a used car dealer that may only sell pounds a month or something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did discuss the notion of a graduated or a scaled bond protection. And let me tell you why it is that from the Department of Justice, at least, we decided that that wasn't something that we could make workable. The reason is that you have to have some kind of a ruler to determine how much of a bond you want to require, how to distinguish between a dealer that requires a $250,000 bond and a dealer in a sliding scale that requires only a $25,000 bond. It struck us at the Department of Justice that we would then require dealers, in order to make that gradation, one way would be to do it on volume of sales. And so that would require us to collect data that we don't presently collect regarding how many cars a given dealer might sell. Another possibility would be to scale the bond based on the assets of the dealer. But again, that would require dealers to disclose their private financial data and for the Department of Justice or some other agency to examine that and make judgments about whether that person had sufficient assets that they could be relied upon to make good on their obligations at a lower bond level than a person with fewer assets. And so that's the reason we didn't pursue that any further from the department standpoint.
Mr. Chairman, another reason that we would oppose such a notion is the fact that the evidence indicates that new dealers less than 5 years old or perhaps less than 3 years old are the ones who most likely put consumers at risk. And since at that level they would be the smallest volume dealers, what you would be doing is taking the highest risk category and requiring them to have the smallest bond, and you would be taking the safest group and having them have the highest bond. Now, that makes sense if you're doing it on a per-volume basis, but if you're doing it on a consumer risk basis, you would flop that around, and you would have those with the fewest sales and perhaps the newest to the marketplace who are most likely to endanger consumers would be the one logically that you would want to have the higher bond to protect consumers because of the greatest risk. The other problem with increasing the bond substantially, by the way, frankly, is this process. We have not had a bond increase in 40 years. And that is because the legislature has not been able to cobble together enough votes and enough support among the various interest groups to increase the bill. We have a long-range goal with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association for a $100,000 bond. That's been part of our long-range plan. We have worked on my boss, Richard Keister, retired after 28 years with the auto dealers. And in 28 years, he could not get a single increase in the bond in this process. We increased the bond from $15,000 to $25,000 this year. And the governor has signed that bill. So that means in approximately 45 years, we have increased all of $10,000. And that does not protect consumers much when you go from $15,000 to $25,000. If we were to increase the bond, if that bill that passed through this process would have gone from $15,000 to $30,000, it wouldn't have passed because we would have had opposition from the used car dealers, and they would have ensured to the best of their ability that the bill failed. The only way we were able to get even a $10,000 increase in the bond is by going with that small of an incremental increase. And while every little bit helps, that does not protect consumers as well as needs to be done. The recovery fund is a proposal after 2 years of work that was able to cobble together enough support within the industry that we believe we've got a winning strategy if we can get the bill to the floor.
Senator Ferrioli is recognized.
Thank you. The discussion that I've been listening to is most informative, but I'm wondering about where this leads, because I think we've chewed through the consumer protection aspect, and I think there's some stuff we've stepped over. The bond function provides more than one set of protections for consumers. It's not just financial. Bonding companies essentially look at the economic capacity and the stability and the ability of the agency to maintain a fiduciary responsibility to consumers. And they have a pretty serious investigatory function. You get a bond, you know, you're asking somebody to risk loss in relative terms, and they have the feeling that the bonding companies are doing a due diligence service for consumers that we may be stepping over here. It isn't just the amount of the bond. The bond function served well to a point, but it doesn't give consumer protection for each occurrence. There's a stopwatch for the bonding company in the amount of the bond. And as we've heard today, I think there might be secondary liability that far exceeds the value that the consumer loses if the dealer fails on each transaction. For instance, if somebody fails to forward license fees, title fees, registration fees, or some other requirement, your credit rating might be affected, your liability might be affected, there could be secondary and tertiary liabilities that pile up, and I'm not sure that you could go past the limits of the bond on every transaction if there was somebody that engaged in a pattern of deception or a pattern of racketeering. And that, I think, is in the experience of the companies in R&D. The recovery fund does a different thing entirely. But it doesn't completely supplant the fiduciary and the investigatory and the surety functions of the bond.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ferrioli, that's absolutely correct, and that is the reason why the bonding requirement is maintained even though there is a recovery fund. I will tell you, based on the financial protection work group that we did over the last 2 years, that the requirements, the fiduciary requirements for a $15,000 bond is that your check doesn't bounce. There's not a lot of financial investigation for a $15,000 bond. At $25,000 bond, the investigation would not be substantially more, but would certainly be more. Again, the auto dealers, Oregon Auto Dealers Association would like to see an increase in the bond. Last year, we had a supporter Department of Justice bill that would have moved the bond to $50,000. We would like to see the bonding companies be more careful in who they issue their bonds too, and the higher that bond amount is, the more careful the bonding company is going to be. The bonding companies indicated during those meetings that they're not necessarily comfortable with being the gatekeepers on who becomes licensed as a dealer and who doesn't. They don't like to be the bad guys that tell somebody, sorry, you don't qualify for a bond, you can't be licensed as a car dealer in Oregon. That is not a function that they necessarily want to serve. Nevertheless, that is part of the bond serves essentially two functions. One is a gatekeeper and two is consumer protection.
But there's also a different level of protection, I think, that Senator Farioli was getting to, and that is that it's not just consumer protection from a consumer standpoint, he who buys the car. It is also government protection, and I appreciate you bringing that out. It protects the government. The government then gets its fees that are being accumulated as a fiduciary by the dealer, and it also is it protects the other folks, the insurance companies that may have credit life and those other folks. So it protects other businesses as well, and I think that's an excellent point that you brought out.
If I could continue.
Please.
Thank you. The Recovery Fund offers a different type of consumer protection in that I perceive it to be more like a mutual fund or mutual insurance fund because it covers each occurrence. It's not just a single occurrence. The bonding feature that I understand, if you blew through $25,000 in coverage, the bond essentially, the bonding company essentially be without further liabilities. The Recovery Fund offers a much broader amount of coverage for the individual dealer, but where I understand it, if the fund runs out of money, there'll be an assessment against the dealers. And that sort of offers this mutuality of spreading the consumer protection across a much broader base and then actually removes that stop loss cap, at least theoretically. So what I'm looking at is that you get coverage, you get a consumer protection aspect, you get each occurrence covered. There's a mutuality of the laws that is a square. I think consumers would be more than happy for the additional coverage to accept the pass-through of the cost on a proportional basis. I would be. You know, for $5 or whatever it is added to the cost of a new car, I don't think that's too much to ask consumers to pay. But the other thing is, inevitably, we're going to get into an argument about who pays first, whether we go to the bonding company first or whether we go to the recovery fund first, and I guess the suggestion I would ask the committee to consider, and this occurred to me yesterday, was a proportionality. And if we have a $25,000 bond and we're looking at a $300,000 loss, that creates a fraction. And that fraction could be the formula that is so elusive in terms of, you know, how you pay, who pays, whether it's a big dealer or a little dealer. In other words, if the bond is $25,000 and the recovery fund is $300,000, you would seek recovery on a proportional basis. And that way you'd have the bonding company standing in priority at the same level that the recovery fund does. They're both in the first position.
I think Mr. Shepard addressed that yesterday, that you dropped all of the resources and the dealer is basically bankrupt and the bonding company has paid out before the state bond takes over.
Yeah, and I'm suggesting to you that perhaps that puts more liability on the bonding company than necessary.
I thought they had reversed that and we were going to do it the other way.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the committee has some amendments labeled the -A5 amendments. And the second section, I believe, of those amendments provides that the order of the sequence of events for a consumer with a claim would be, first the consumer would have to file a lawsuit, would have to win. Then they would obtain a judgment from the court, and then they would have to exhaust every reasonable effort to collect that judgment from the dealer. Now, in the hypothetical, in fact, the case that most likely would result in a claim on the fund, then we're assuming the dealer is not available. No, there are no assets from the dealer. Under the -A5 amendments, the consumer would take that judgment to the fund. The fund's payments would be capped at $30,000 per consumer, or a total of $250,000. Then, only if the consumer was still had some portion of that judgment unsatisfied that was payable from the fund, would the consumer be able to seek payment from the bonding company.
And Mr. Chairman, I understand that priority and I understand the amendment. What I'm suggesting is that may lead some people to conclude that the bond is to do it. Point of fact, if you have a $250,000 limit, when you hit the limit and it's exhausted, you'll assess the auto dealers and refund or refill the fund. So I guess my suggestion is that the liability be concurrent and proportional.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand Senator Perriola's question on that point. Let me see if I can answer it. The replenishment, the special assessment for the fund does not increase the amount available to pay consumer claims for a particular dealership failure. If the Fuller Automotive fails and Mr. Fuller has no assets to make good on the judgments that have been lodged against Fuller Automotive, those are capped. The total amount of payments from the fund would be capped at $30,000 per claimant and a total of $250,000 for that dealership failure.
But that's after the Full Employment Act for attorneys at that point, because you've got the consumer filing a lawsuit, the consumer winning a lawsuit, the consumer perfecting a judgment, and then executing a judgment, and then being able to come back and show the fund. We're talking about, well, what's the time period that we're talking about? In between each one of those, you've got a certain number of weight. You might be 9 months to a year before they show up at your door empty-handed.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and we made a conscious decision not to allow the fund to pay anything except that which had been reduced to a judgment, because otherwise you'd have the fund in a position of trying to decide disputed matters of fact.
And would the fund then pay the year's worth of legal fees as well?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no. The fund caps the legal fees at $500, and anything in excess of $500 may only be paid first if it resulted from a contested case, so that if the consumer sues the dealer and the dealer, because the dealer is in Belize, doesn't contest that case, if the consumer's lawyer submits a claim for $2,500, only $500 of that is going to be paid from the fund. However, if there's been a contested case, the dealer battles the consumer, and the consumer runs up $5,000 in attorney's fees, or $10,000 for that matter, still, the only part of that judgment for attorney's fees that the fund pays automatically is $500. And then the board has to make a decision as to whether to pay any amount in addition to that. So we did not want to create an incentive here for people to file litigation in order to seek access to the deep pocket. I think we've plugged that hole with the requirement that the board approve anything over $500.
Sure, I guess my example is predicated more on the concept that there could be two or three failures that are simultaneous. You do have a cap of $250,000 per dealership. The total fund balance is $300,000.
Total fund balance, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perriola, the total fund balance is $700,000, which prepares for the possibility of three major losses in a single year, which has never occurred.
Is that whole process so
expensive? Can't happen.
The consumer never makes anything out of it. He ends up just paying all the legal fees, and whatever he gets, it's still not much of anything.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I think one reason that the consumer law section of the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Consumer League do support this proposal is that it represents actually a significant improvement over the current situation, because the current situation is that the consumer still has to go through the hoops of filing a lawsuit and obtaining a judgment, finding a lawyer who's willing to do that. And then it has to collect that judgment from the bond, which is usually the only asset. You may recall that I mentioned in my testimony yesterday that there, in one case that a consumer lawyer wrote to me about, the consumers only end up collecting 7 cents on the dollar. Under the recovery fund, that consumer likely would have recovered all of their money, plus at least $500 of their attorney's fees. So I think the answer is it will be a quantum leap forward for consumers in that.
The concern I have with the 7 cents on a dollar is they probably spent 12 cents for attorney's fees in order to get the 7 cents, and that was my concern. And the representative naturally has some questions relative to the larger dealers and vehicles, larger vehicle dealers, and your business folks. Yeah, the tenants on your session, and we're on your session now too. So,
but Mr. Chair, I guess I don't even want to answer right now because we do have to go back to office on the floor, but I am interested in returning to the definition of the leader. And also, I think you raised the question yesterday, Mr. Chair, about the insurance pool, the state pool. I don't think we've heard an answer on that. And I guess I I don't have a good feeling about all this, to be real honest. I wonder if we're not really dealing with the problem yet in a very efficient manner. And I'm not sure, at least in my mind, we've really identified the problem. If it's not the big dealers, which I'm not real comfortable there because I'm familiar with one dealer who was criticized because of the problem. But then we've got the real small one, too. The 20, 30 cars lost and that type of thing. And is it fair to require them to pay at that $250,000 level? I would like for my satisfaction to have this thing identified, Mr. Chair.
And Representative, let me say this. I think that through the process of the work group, which started back in 1997, something that Mr. Fuller has brought out is actually occurred, and that is that for the first time in 42 years, there is an increase in the bond. And that's an excellent first step. The question is, how quickly can we move that bond to the $100,000 level that you'd like to have it eventually moved to, and still keep, because your good actors are going to be able to come forward and do that, and it has the winnowing effect of keeping good actors in the market as much as possible. But the graduated issue that I've asked Mr. Shepherd about, I would still like to see something looked at there, but I appreciate the other testimony that's been given and the aspect of the bond. The bonding company really acts as the gatekeeper in the process because they're the ones that come forward and say, we're not going to issue a $25,000 bond to this company because they just don't have the resources to. They've got everything filed to get into the dealership. Maybe it isn't a dealership. Maybe it's just a used car operation. I've seen, and I know you as a banker, as a bank board member, have seen issues dealing with new car dealerships. I don't know what the figures are. It's been a number of years since I've worked on what the entrance requirement for any of the Detroit or foreign automobile dealerships have been, but it used to be that in addition to $250,000 for the franchise, that front cash that you had to have in the dealership, that you had to make commitments of a minimum of about $1 million in the issues of your parts and your shop and your materials and those kinds of things. Then you had to own your facility or have a long-term, fairly good lease and those kinds of things. So it was more difficult. It was more difficult to set up a new car dealership in the 70s and 80s, as I recall, and early 90s. It was more difficult financially and to pass muster with each. My recollection was that you go to region and then you go to area and then pretty soon Detroit signs off and then you get all of this back through. But it's got to be today. Any major automobile dealership is going to have probably $2 million. A franchise operation is going to have to come in showing about $2 million worth of fairly, probably 50% of that, at least 50%, probably fairly liquid, ready to move into the dealership itself, exclusive of the real estate. And so the bonding company becomes your gatekeeper there. I don't think those are the folks you're really worried about, though.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. In fact, I could make a fairly effective argument that new car dealers, franchise dealers, shouldn't have to bond at all because they are more than protected. Consumers are more protected through the franchise agreement than they are through a $15,000 or $25,000 bond. It is more of an annoying overhead cost than anything else. From a political standpoint, removing the bonding requirement from franchise new car dealers and requiring used car dealers to have it would probably not sell too well, and there are the examples of new car dealers that do go under.
Let me interrupt, if I may, for just a moment. We're over time, but let me just suggest this as a possibility for discussion, and that is, according to Mr. Shepherd, absent from part of the discussions were the bonding companies themselves. I'm wondering if in the process here, the bonding company shouldn't come to the meetings themselves and offer packages of their own making, of their own blend, which still offer the $25,000 bond. That's a new rate that we've asked now, passed for statute, but also offer Fidelity as a portion of that. Maybe get a little more ingenuity in the whole process, so that what you're asking for is and not required by statute. Again, I know that when you throw the cost of the bond at $1,300 using or $1,500 under some example, $1,300 under your federated example, if you were to come to the table and say, yeah, we'll pay the $1,500, but we would like everybody in the upstairs office that does the paperwork to have a $10,000 fidelity bond, and that $10,000 fidelity bond for the whole office another $1,500, maybe the insurance company would write that whole package for $2,500 or something like that, and thus cheapening the whole process. And I'm sure some dealers must do that. Some insurance companies must do that.
Federated Insurance offers franchise new car dealers their bonds as a courtesy.
I see. And then what happens is the dealership bond, or the dealership insurance then, becomes what it is. Okay, that's where your cost is absorbed. Well, we successfully went the Democrats, I beg your pardon, the Democrats in the House had a caucus at 9:30 and were excused, and the Senate had their meeting start at 10 and ours at the House at 10. Do we know what our schedule may look like for tomorrow? Okay. It's my understanding that we will be coming back. I've mentioned it to members of the Senate. We will be coming back to recast on a summer budget. And we've got that. It's going to have to be done. What I'd like to do is I'd like to go ahead and set for the present time 9:00 tomorrow as our continuing public hearing and possible work session on this bill, and get through as many of the issues we possibly can. In all fairness, we probably should hear from I would like to hear from Kelly Taylor. I would like to hear from someone from the bonding companies themselves to make sure that they're part of the process. And then I think Tom and Dave Rhodes, one or the other, will want to have relative to the amendments that we have. We just need to move forward as rapidly as we can. So let's plan for 9:00. Please watch the calendar for any changes. And then I'm anticipating that any assembly budget would probably be passed separate and apart at a different hour than what we have scheduled here. We'll go ahead and finish today's public hearing. Thank you very much.